This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, the state's aquatic resources staff is meeting with Kauai fishermen. It's asking for Kokua to help round up large schools of tilapia that have been sighted on the Garden Isles nearshore waters. We talked to Ka'ili Shaler about the massive effort that's about to get underway.
We're just trying to meet with some of the community organizers from both the west side and the north shore to try to put together a list of people to come and help with the removal efforts. And then also we're going to just put together a game plan day. We're trying to find some nets to use and figuring out when is the best time frame for people to be able to join us and help remove. We're trying to put together boat support to get down there and get volunteers to come down and help. So that doesn't kind of happen overnight. We're trying to work as many ends as possible.
So what types of things do you need? You talked about nets.
Yeah, so some of the nets that we actually need are illegal size netting. So we can't really expect the public to have that kind of netting. So we either have to purchase netting or we're trying to see if there are available nets that Dole Care has that aren't being used for evidence right now in open cases we may possibly be able to borrow.
Are these what, smaller mesh nets?
Yeah, smaller eye mesh nets, yeah.
So talk about the extent of the problem with the tilapia.
Usually on the Napali coast, you'd think of, you know, the ocean environment, you know, marine-related fish. And we're seeing a large recruitment of, you know, this species that we've come to think of as more of a freshwater species. Now, the species tilapia, the black chin, it was imported by as a food source, as a commercial food source. But, you know, after years of it being here in the islands, it's kind of worked their way out into the streams. And, you know, now we're starting to see them more in places that have salt water, like in estuaries and brackish water. And they seem to be able to kind of osmoregulate their internal salinity to be able to withstand, you know, changes in the external environment for short periods of time. So, yeah, so we've been kind of seeing them come from the west side and move down the Napali coast, and now they're at Mililii and Nu'ulolo, and we haven't really been seeing these large numbers before in these areas, like by the thousands. So kind of want to nip it in the bud before it kind of extends further on down the Napali.
And what's the threat with having these large schools of these tilapia?
So as of right now, their size is between, you know, 3 inches to about 8 inches. The mouths of the tilapia, while right now some of the smaller ones aren't able to fit, you know, fish into them, some of the larger ones will be able to pick off some of the smaller manini and aholehole and wowo, you know, as they get bigger if they're not being predated upon. So the threat would be that they not only displace the native fish that, you know, we normally see down there that fishermen fish for food, but that they're actually also predating on them and eating them. And the worst case that we will have is that, you know, we have an entire loss of species populations from this season of recruitment for those kind of fish that we normally would have there. It's understandable to see, you know, like 25, 30, 40, 50, but when we're seeing thousands upon thousands, it kind of makes you really alarmed at, like, the rate at which it can be spreading, especially because Napali right now, it has a lot of fresh water that comes along that coast. So those tilapia can survive if there's enough fresh water that will allow mixing for them to be able to, like, get fresh water to regulate their internal salinity. And there is that along the Napoli right now. There's water coming down off of the mountains. There's also groundwater coming out from underneath. And we want to kind of get them out before they start spreading down the coast to Hanakapi'i, you know, when the winter swells start coming and taking all the sand away and opening up that water again, the water flow from Hanakapi'i, moving down the coast to Waimea, Lumaha'i. These estuaries might have a few tilapia here and there, but not at the rate at which we're seeing right now at Nu'alolo and Mililili.
I mean, DLNR was saying that, yeah, this is kind of critical. We have to take some emergency steps to deal with this.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, we're going to start seeing our winter swells, our west northwest swells start stacking in probably maybe as soon as September. We've seen them as soon as September, October. So that gives us about a month to try to take care of a problem before we start getting into a place that's going to be inaccessible for the next 6 months. We're trying to see about getting some surround nets. We have a bunch of throw nets, but the issue with throw nets is, you know, every time you throw, it scares the fish away. And from my experience being out there collecting samples using a throw net, there's larger tilapia that are around the 6 to 8 inches size. They're strong enough to work up the lead lines and escape underneath the throw net. So, like, I've seen it firsthand when I was throwing, and I landed on a whole pile, and all these bigger ones just worked their way out.
Wow.
And what was left was the smaller ones that couldn't get the line.
And do we know anything about tilapia in the ocean in any other place? Is there anyone else we could reach out to understand more about how they survive out there in the ocean like that?
I know that we know we have a lot of these ditch systems out on the west side that don't flush too often and too regularly, and there are tilapia throughout the entire like stream system, and so some of those can make their way down with these heavy rains and flush out of these ditch systems and into our ocean. But at these levels that we haven't been able to really see this too much. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with Nu'alolo. Nu'alolo is actually it's a small valley on the western end of the Napali, and it has a small rocky beach, and there's a reef, two reef lots on either side of it that hold a lot of fish, and plenty of guys go out there to go throw net and fish and pickle peaky and things like that. But right now, they're all congregated by the thousands on these flats of reef along the rocky shoreline between Nu'alolo and Mililili'i. And so for us, we need to do surround netting around these big piles and putty-putty and scare them as close to the shore as possible so we can pull the net and pull them out.
I see.
Water.
So that's the strategy.
Yeah, that's going to be our strategy right now because they are getting preyed upon by jacks and other predatory species out there. We saw omilu going in and trying to whack the smaller ones and eat them. But, I mean, they can get full pretty quick when there's thousands of them.
So basically the bigger fish are coming in. For dinner.
Yeah, some of the bigger fish are coming in and eating them, but not at the rate that we would like to see for this to just happen naturally.
All right. Yeah, we need some help here, right?
Yeah. And, like, right now on Kauai, like, our office, we're in the midst of trying to recruit for more help. I mean, recruit for more positions in our agency and our staff. But right now, we're kind of understaffed, and it's just me and my technician right now that's been working around the clock trying to, like, deal with multiple issues. And I wish we could be out there all the time, like helping to remove it. But, I mean, we're a resource management agency, so there's other resource issues that we need to help.
Right, you're stretched thin. So yeah. We feel for you. We feel for you. So hopefully you get, after this community meeting, you'll get a better handle, and hopefully folks will step up.
That's why we wanna lend the invitation out to the fishermen on, you know, the west and the north side that use these areas to help participate and to be involved with, you know, this removal effort, because they use these areas, they feed their families from these areas, and it's a meaningful place for them, and it's impacting their ability to do those kinds of things.
That was Ka'ili Shaler, who's with the Department of Land and Natural Resources Aquatics Division on Kauai. He was talking about the planning involved in removing the thousands of tilapia that have washed into the ocean from freshwater streams. For links on how to help the effort, go to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites you to a screening of Moana Nui Akea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Sunday, August 18th in Waimea on Hawaii Island, Sunday, August 25th in Honolulu, and Saturday, August 31st in Lihue. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Dawson.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking at Hawaii's tourism history, long before the advent of the Carnival or Norwegian cruise lines. We're taking you back to 1926, when a certain commercial ocean-going vessel was first built. It made headlines for being the most expensive and fastest merchant ship constructed in the United States at the time. The price tag came out to $8 million and was top of the line in luxury sea travel. It had 7 decks, a swimming pool, ballroom, gymnasium, and space for 650 passengers. With a 27-knot cruising speed, it could make the crossing from San Francisco to Honolulu in only 4.5 days. Its trips to Hawaii brought thousands of tourists to the islands, and more specifically to the newly opened Royal Hawaiian Hotel. The hotel was owned by the same shipping company which had built the impressive ocean liner for the very purpose of bringing eager tourists to the hotel's newly opened halls. Now, the synergy between hotel and luxury passenger ships helped fuel a tourism boom for Hawaii. And today, we're looking for the name of the ship and, for extra credit, the name of its owner. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm CJ.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Bronson.
From the Manoa School of Communications.
You're listening to The Conversation,
a member-supported
Hawaii Public Radio.
We watched the drama play out on our streets last summer when the company Lime dropped 200 of its electric scooters in our Honolulu. The move was made without the city's blessing, and it quickly moved to seize the vehicles, maintaining they were illegal. The disruption prompted the city to try and find a way to avoid a repeat. This month, two bills were introduced to try and manage things like dockless scooters and bikes. Council Chair Ikaika Anderson introduced Bill 43. Bill 44 is the administration's version. John Noucci is the Deputy Director of Transportation Services. The focus, he says, is to find the best solution to managing new technology on our streets.
you know, traditionally when we think multimodal, we think of what we already have. We have bus, we have our handy van system, we're building the 20-mile rail alignment. And so those are the kind of the trifecta that people usually think about when they refer to multimodal. However, there's all these other pieces that have suddenly arisen in this time of, you know, we have scooters, we have bike share, Honolulu, by the way, has one of the highest utilized bike shares in the nation. I think we're sixth in the nation right now in terms of bike utilization. So it speaks to the success of Bike Share Hawaii's Biki product. And so you have all these other pieces that are kind of breaking the mold of what we consider to be multimodal. Even recently, Bill 19, Ordinance 19, which revised ordinances to allow more car sharing in Honolulu. That is actually a piece of our multimodal network there. And so when we look at it, any new device that hits the road that people can use as a piece of their transport is part of our multimodal network. So Mayor came out very strong when one of the companies decided to deploy. And it wasn't because he was against the mode at all. But we need to deploy these things in a thoughtful, prescribed way. Because we've seen, I wouldn't even say across the nation, but across the world, we've seen that chaos that develops when companies that are normally, say, a tech disruptor company come and just drop a plethora of scooters or bikes or other devices on the sidewalks and just leave everybody to figure out how to best manage these devices being, you know, and it turns into a bunch of clutter and it turns into just not looking very nice in our streetscape. So what Mayor has always intended to do is to figure out, this is not a no-can for these kinds of dockless shared mobility devices. It's a how-can. How can we prescriptively, how can we integrate this into our streetscape? And you can visit any major American city or any major international city and see shared mobility devices all over. The difference is you can see the cities that have done it right, and you can see the cities that have not done it right. And I like to kind of refer to them as you can see cities that are the permissive parent and you can see the cities that are the absolutely no parent, where they say, no, we're not doing this. And I hope that Honolulu falls right in the middle of that. We want to be permissive, but not at the cost of safety, not at the cost of accessibility, not at the cost of making sure that our streetscape remains nice to look at and pleasant to traverse.
Now, at the mayor's conference recently, there were a number of mayors who stood up and said, you know, we're proud of the fact that we had so many, you know, rides on electric scooters or electric bikes, and it was a way to be able to go green and either get people away from their love affair with their cars, but just provide other options.
Absolutely. And the reason why we're considering this as part of our multimodal network is just that options are so key to letting people traverse through our city and wherever they need to go with as much ease as possible. I mean, sometimes it might be better, and I do know this to be true. I've been stuck in traffic before and on a bus, which I do ride all the time, and we've had something happen on the road, and we're in town, and I just happened to hop off the bus and say, you know what, I'm going to take my bike. I'm going to take a bike share bike and just get to where I'm going to go. And that option, that you have other options, really gets to the point of what makes a great multimodal city. The two bills, actually, they aim towards the same end, to have a well-managed shared mobility program implemented in the city and county of Honolulu that does make whoever participates in, does make them liable to paying the cost for using a space on city property. And I think that's quite key right there.
Is the key going to be dockless versus docked in how these bills try and tackle this problem?
Well, fundamentally, there's a couple large differences between the two bills. Bill 43 takes a stab at defining all the different types of different devices that are known to us right now. We intentionally, in crafting Bill 44 for the administration, left that open and just defined a small shared mobility device, because I think, as you'll see evolve, we don't really know what's yet to come. And so in Bill 44, what we had hoped to do was just to take the concept of a vehicle that's meant to be shared and is less than 100 pounds and to anticipate to kind of future-proof ordinances, which I think does help to craft, you know, good legislation.
This summer I visited D.C., and I saw just multiple types of electric scooters, electric bikes everywhere. But their sidewalks are like five times the size of our sidewalks.
Broad sidewalks, exactly. You have that opportunity. So in some ways, the companies that are deploying dockless mobility, such as scooters and bikes, I think to them, they just come and they deploy in a city. And that was the strategy that they did over the last 2 years. And it really has not been that long since this mobility was available. I think they've learned, though, from pushback from municipalities across the country and around the world, that every city is not a cookie cutter. Every city demands its own personalized solution. And I think both Bill 43 and 44 aim to literally corral, shared mobility devices into organized places on the street. And that gets to something that the city's been really focusing on a lot, and that is the concept of curb management. Curb management is recognizing that all the business value of city streets, which Mayor always says is probably one of the largest assets of the city in the amount of space that we have dedicated to our roads and streets. Curb management is managing the areas where business takes place on the curb. And really, that's the last frontier of conflict and business. If you think about it, our transit buses use those to pick up all of our passengers on our well-utilized bus system. They have to share that with delivery vehicles that now in online era shopping, you know, there's so many delivery vehicles all over the place trying to kind of also utilize the curb and make their deliveries. You have commercial freight vehicles, you know, delivering food and other goods to businesses. And you have rideshare, Uber, Lyft, also using that curb. So really that curb frontage is so, so, so valuable. And so to assume that the curb is also the place that scooters and bikes will also coexist, we just have to make sure that the curb is well-managed and that well-defined and that we know that we have to utilize the best to our ability the precious curb space that we do have.
The idea then, get some broad structure in place so you don't have to be playing catch-up with the technology so that it kind of covers all the bases.
Correct. And, you know, you can look at, in history, even if you look into our ordinance, a bunch of years ago, there was a Christmas fad where you had a Razor scooter that had a combustion engine on it. And we actually, as a city, the city council at that time took up a bill that actually put laws around that particular device. And it spec'd it out. It has a combustion engine with a deck and two wheels and went to that level. And then the device doesn't really exist anymore. And even to that point, Segways are also defined in the city ordinance. I think they're called personal mobility assistive devices. So rather than try to anticipate what's coming, we wanted to have a broad stroke categorization of these devices that are intended to be rented or purchased for use on a mobile app or some other mobile portal, and that concept would be encountered in the ordinance that the administration put out.
Now, just this summer, I saw a number of electric scooters on the road on King Street in the bike lane.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to be there, are they?
Well, and that's part of the whole evolution of things. I think we have to look at what is allowed in the bike lane. And as all these devices evolve, you know, if it makes sense that is the safest place for them to be, then so be it. Then we have to revise our ordinances to allow for those things. When we've taken a look and gauged how the community feels about scooters in general, we found that a lot of people don't believe that electric scooters, which can go up to 14 or 15 miles an hour, should not be sharing our limited sidewalk space with pedestrians. And to that end, I think that's where a lot of people draw the line, is that they feel that there can be a lot of potential for conflict, for accident, for injury, if you have these scooters on the sidewalk, and especially in busy areas. So in certain areas, in business districts, like, for example, Waikiki, we don't allow bicycles on the sidewalk because we think that there's a great conflict and a potential for injury. So to that end, that is a huge encouragement for us to know that we have to increase our bike infrastructure. And when I say bike infrastructure, I'm talking about lanes that we have set aside, protected bike lanes or shared bike lanes or anything of that network, and assume that at some point we'll be using all kinds of devices in it. So last year, the city held the first of its urban mobility working groups. And part of that effort was to kind of shake the tree and see who would come out and see what kind of devices were even contemplated. And we had a whole slew of different types of devices come out and get represented. And some you can't even really classify it. We had folding scooters that were electric that actually had a seat and you sit almost, you know, kind of like bunched up and hunched over, but it goes 20 miles an hour. We saw people who had a deck with one wheel on it, and those hoverboards, for example, that were popular probably from about 2 years ago, those people came out. We had regular skateboarders, adult skateboarders in their 30s and 40s come out, and they were like, you know, we're not doing tricks on these anymore, but we're using them legitimately to get around town. And so when you look at that whole, the diversity of all those devices, that's what we want to contemplate in terms of shared mobility. I mean, someone could make a shared skateboard service at some point, and that really could happen. You know, right. We haven't seen it yet, but it could happen.
So we've got to be ready for that.
Yes. Safety is going to be our first priority here. If it's not safe, we don't want to condone it. We don't want to welcome it to our city.
That was John Nochi, Deputy Director of Transportation Services for the city.
Coming Saturday, August 24th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's a big band with an even bigger sound that will make you want to dance. Agua Dulce Salsa Band brings their ensemble sound of salsa, featuring splashes of reggae, hip-hop, jazz, and funk. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Amoresco.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bike Marks Cafe, we'll find out about the latest developments in co-working in Hawaii. We'll talk to the managers of Impact Hub and hear about their expansion to Hawaii Kai and plans for another 10 throughout the state. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bike Marks Cafe.
We've been hearing a lot about climate change, but besides rising sea levels, how's it affecting our beaches? Well, that's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle joins us today. Morning.
Good morning.
So, how are beaches more dangerous?
There's a long list of ways that beaches are more dangerous. So, after talking to different emergency officials, health officials, scientists, others, lifeguards, of course, it's across the board. It's everything from them having to relocate towers. We've already seen that at Sunset, Pipeline, Chuns, Waikiki, and on neighbor islands as well. As the erosion increases and intensifies, they have to keep kind of backing up. In some places, they're actually running out of places to back up to, like in Waikiki. We're also looking at more jellyfish, possibly, as the ocean warms. That's a good breeding ground for them. We're looking at more powerful rip currents from higher sea levels, more exposure to waterborne diseases from increased flooding and runoff, and even more heat-related diseases potentially as temperatures increase and we see fewer days with good trade winds.
I think for those of us that are out in the ocean a lot, the rip currents kind of worry me the most.
Absolutely, yeah. To me as well, because they're kind of a, you know, as you're familiar with, a hidden danger. And so it's not just that there will be maybe stronger rip currents, but they also might move. And that's because of a series of events that may occur where the corals bleach from warmer temperatures and more acidic ocean waters. and they collapse, the reef systems collapse. So you may have a beach that you're familiar with. Okay, the rip current's way over there on the left side. I'll stay out of that, or I know how to get out of it. But now it may be in a different location, which is very concerning.
Yeah, that is a scary part for me. And I know you talked about the bacteria in the water. I like to swim with a head mount snorkel just because I open my mouth less and, you know, aren't maybe ingesting some of the stuff from the cesspools that might be leaching into the water.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's going to have to be a lot more precautions for that. And in talking to the state health director, Bruce Anderson, he was saying we can expect to see more than likely an increased amount of brown water advisories. So it's all the more important to sign up for those email alerts that you can get on the state health department's website. And that's just because there's going to be more flooding. The waters from the ocean may inundate some of those coastal cesspools. And, of course, Hawaii has more cesspools, I think, than anywhere in the country, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, and I think we're still allowing cesspools or homes to be built with cesspools. And I think they're trying to get their arms around that. But it's a challenge because it's expensive to switch over to the sewer system or something else besides the cesspool.
It's a super expensive and complicated problem. It may seem simple, and service is like, okay, we'll just quit using your cesspool, but it puts homeowners in a potential bind. So they've been trying things like tax credits and things like that with mixed success. And I think there is a task force that's looking at solutions now.
Yeah, there's been a lot of pushback on that issue. You also mentioned the coral bleaching, and I know the coral ecologists at the Coconut Island labs over there are worried because this next month is going to be another hot one, and they think we're already seeing some effect on the corals.
Oh, 100%. You know, as Josh Stambro was telling me, he's the Honolulu's chief resiliency officer. The corals are doing a lot more than just providing habitat for fish and things. He likened it to like a natural fortress, basically, for us. A huge seawall offshore that, diffuses the power of waves and storms as they come in. And that's going to be all the more important, of course, with climate change, increasing the frequency of the tropical storms that we experience out here. This is a super important thing to keep our eye on.
And then what else did Josh Stambro of the Climate Change Office say about just about us losing our sand and how that affects the beach?
Well, he's particularly concerned about seawalls because as erosion eats away our shoreline and homeowners and business owners are trying to protect, their properties, they're trying to get these seawalls in. And that will protect what's behind it, but it will also destroy the beaches that are on either side potentially. So he's concerned that with fewer beaches, then the beaches that we do have become more crowded. And so that creates, more bodies in the water for the lifeguards to try to keep an eye on. Or alternatively, if people are still trying to access those same beaches with less sandy entry, it just becomes more dangerous to enter those waters.
Oh, yeah. And I think you've seen that over in Kailua where you see the concrete in the rebar on the beaches. That's kind of scary.
Yep, absolutely. We're seeing that in Waikiki as well, where the old tavern at Kuhio Beach is being exposed, the foundation. It was exposed just Monday when I was out there.
And then has there been any talk about money and, what we can do to minimize the impacts?
Yeah, in large part, they're looking at temporary or recurring solutions. The legislature and others are putting millions of dollars towards sand replenishment projects at places like Waikiki or more popular beaches.
And I know it probably seems like a recipe for disaster. So not only do we have rising sea levels, climate change, but we have record numbers of tourists, record numbers of people in the ocean.
Exactly. It's one of those problems that just kind of compounds when we factor all of those things just together.
And then any other sense from these different agencies that you talked to about just the immediate things that we can do to deal with this?
Well, one thing they're looking at, lifeguards anyway, is more roving patrol units. So they'll have their towers and they'll move them, but then they'll also have more lifeguards, on jet skis or ATVs or even just in trucks kind of patrolling beaches where they can make decisions on a daily basis. Okay, we should be posted here because it's more popular today.
Yeah, that's right. I recall that conversation in regard to like Electric Beach and that area on the west side because with the resort district at Ihilani, I know they're concerned with more people going to unguarded beaches. So that's a whole nother wrinkle.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's 40-some towers, lifeguard towers on Oahu for our 170-some beaches. So a lot of remote and unguarded beaches.
All right. Okay, well, thanks so much, Nathan.
Thanks.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read his stories on this issue, visit civilbeat.org.
Hi, I'm Aki from AIA Honolulu. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
In today's backyard quiz, we remember the days when the newly opened Royal Hawaiian Hotel and the luxury liner, ocean liner, that brought the mainland tourists to the hotel helped establish Hawaii as a tourist destination. Now, when it was built in 1926, the price tag on this ship was $8 million, or almost $110 million adjusted for inflation. Now, with six decks and room for 650 passengers, it represented the height of luxury in the 1920s and 30s. The inclusion of the latest in safety standards allowed our mystery ship to survive a serious collision in 1927 during its sea trials, the impact which was equal in force to the one that had sunk the Titanic 15 years earlier. The vessel, known as the Malolo, or Flying Fish, went on to become one of the legends of ocean travel and the pride of its owner, Matson Shipping Lines. Congratulations to our winner, Doug Hope of Waimea. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On our Hawaii Garden and Forest segment, we continue exploring a California public garden with Hawaii maritime ties. The Matson name has dominated shipping in the Pacific. You see the name emblazoned on shipping containers across the state. But the Matson twin granddaughters, Lurline and Brennis, came out in society in the Bay Area and were launched like luxury liners, according to the newspapers at the time. Curator Julie Blythe DeVere recounts the Hawaii history and the impact of World War II. The Matson family did not escape the impact of the internment camps and the Chinese Exclusion Act. The Failoli Estate and Public Gardens were started first by William Bourne and then William and Lurline Matson Roth.
Both families had maritime connections, but of course, the Roth family had the Matson Hawaii connection most. So her father, Captain William Matson, had really started a lot of transportation back and forth between Hilo and San Francisco. And he started that in 1882 with the Emma Claudina. It was a little schooner that he started taking back and forth when it was still the Kingdom of Hawaii. He was working and bringing supplies from the mainland and then bringing back things like coconut and native woods. He was trying to make a go of railroad ties out of them here and filling his hold back up. He was also bringing back a lot of sugar and sandalwood and doing that back and forth. And then he just kind of kept increasing the size of his ships. It became a 400-ton brigantine next, the Lurline, the first Lurline. But he started going back and forth. And over time, especially after the annex of the kingdom, sugar production was doubling and he was bringing more sugar back and forth to the mainland. And then he got really involved in Honolulu Oil, Consolidated Oil Company. He was very involved in Honolulu Plantation and about a half dozen other island kind of trade and merchants. And so he had a lot of different kind of fingers into the merchant area there, back and forth. And so their family kind of continued to grow and expand over time. So he was the first one to have an electrified ship with cold storage, taking things back and forth to Hilo. And then he was the first to have steam, and then he was really involved with the oil line going back and forth, especially one that was bringing the oil fields of California all the way to the Pacific coast. There was a 118-mile long pipeline that he helped put in. And so as that trade grew, Mattson seemed to always be there. And after Lurline's father, her husband, who was born in Honolulu, William Roth himself was born when it was still the Kingdom of Hawaii. And he came out to the mainland, to Oakland, and then later to Stanford University for his education. But then he went back to Hawaii and worked as a bank teller and then a sugar broker, and then meets and falls in love with Lurline when she's visiting the islands with her family. And she went back and forth almost every year, you know, with her father and her mother. And he ends up kind of working for Mattson, and under his leadership, especially in the 20s into the 40s, that's when you have the White Line cruise ship going in and really developing Waikiki. He then thought, well, I have this beautiful cruise ship and it's ending in Waikiki, which he remembers when you saw 10 people on the beach, you know, and he said, well, all of these tourists now have nowhere that they can stay on the island. And so that was when he developed the hotels, the Royal Hawaiian, the Surf Rider, the Princess Kalani, like all of those were under his leadership. And then they really move into containerization and shipping. And so maritime trade, and especially a connection to the islands, has always been important to them and continues, I think, to be a part of their history. We just recently had one of Lurline Roth's grandchildren here visiting, and Artie, you know, Arthur Grant, he plays the ukulele beautifully, and he sings love songs on it that he learned from his grandparents, you know, and so there was even that cultural kind of tradition, and they still kind of greet family during important events with flower lei, and a lot of that has carried through and still important to them, you can tell.
I was reading somewhere on one of the oral histories that was published that Lurline used to gather the flowers in the morning and then bring them back for the arrangements in the house, mm-hmm. and that they would also display them in the calabashes downstairs.
She had an amazing collection of calabash, and we're really lucky that she left those to us and that they remain here in our collection. And we, of course, kind of treasure them. And they go into storage for a little bit to have time to rest and then come back out. And so they're still here. I love that at a time when she kind of needed a little bit of self-care and love, Lurline went back to Hawaii. She built her own estate right next to the Mauna Kea Resort. She built that beautiful 9.7, you know, 6-acre estate. And that after she lost her husband as a recent widow, that was really where she kind of needed a little bit of time for herself. I love those pictures of her, you know, when she's visiting the island, especially in her later years. She was in her 80s. She developed this beautiful home. She worked with, you know, an architect locally. It was 10 steps to the water's edge. Big, expansive walls, views to really kind of soak in the island, right there next to, like, Lawrence Rockefeller's beautiful estate that he had built, right? That she wanted to be there, and that place that had been so important to her throughout her childhood was a place where she could kind of have a little bit of a balm for the soul.
When I was here last, you had the Mattson menus up on display. I don't know if that's part of a permanent thing or if you rotate things in and out.
Yeah, for many years we used to have them up in the kitchen. Right now they're in the visitor center in a display case. We have two in there in the gallery, and one is the Bourne family history and the other is the Roth family history. And it's just kind of soaked into the view that you take in, that it's immediately the Pacific was important, the tropical, floral. There isn't a family picture during parties that you don't see tropical flowers that were specifically brought to the mainland for events happening here. Even if it was giant displays of beautiful orchids and things being brought in specifically for like the twins' debut party, you just kind of instantly see that Pacific Island connection was so important for the family. And again, even in those family photos, you often see Lurleen and Bill wearing flower lei surrounded by their children here in California. So it's still important.
I saw one of the pictures in the showcase has a horse draped in lei because they used to raise horses here on the property.
Yeah, Mrs. Roth is perhaps most well known here locally for her incredible horse breeding facility that she had here for many years. Their other estate was the Waiwuri Farm, which was also here in Woodside. And it's said that when she moved to Failoli, she brought just the brood mares with her, so maybe only 50. But she had she competed almost every year except for during the war years when she was running the Red Cross. She was president of the local chapter. And her horses won every accolade and every award that they could, nationally, internationally. And she was often out there in the ring herself. Horses have continued to be really important. And so when you visit the property here, you see the green fences all over the property that were all their different paddocks. But yeah, they would do these big, beautiful flower lays that would go up over, you know, their neck. And then she would always present them with a vanilla ice cream cone out in the middle of the ring. She would feed them one. And you can see they're all perked up and so excited that they're going to get a treat because they know that they did well.
That's a great story. Anything else you can share? I know Kara had mentioned that they had, I think she had a Japanese butler, I think. And one of the stories that I read was, I think it was Lurleen, I think had to drive him down to one of the internment camps in the city during the war. That was kind of a sensitive issue.
Yeah, that's what's amazing about telling these new stories in the house is it does allow us the opportunity to tell a lot of new stories in the house. And one of them is about Tachiki Taga. And the family, as is the case, you always call your butler by their last name. So whether it was Sidney Woods, and he was Woods during the Bourne era, or Taga during the Roth era, he was one of the butlers here, and he had worked for over 25 years at the time of Japanese internment starting here on the mainland. And it was heartbreaking, you know, and it's so hard. And she remembers having to take him and his wife and their American-born daughter. She was, you know, born and raised here in San Francisco on the peninsula, and going into internment. And then the family went and picked them up at the end, and they continued to work for the family until their retirement years. We also, with our Chinese cook, we have the Chinese Exclusion Act, which is so another difficult part of California history here. We have a lecture series coming up later this summer that's connected to NEST. We're bringing in other local historians who specialize in internment in the Chinese Exclusion Act so that I can borrow their expertise and make sure that we're really giving the context as to what those difficult periods of history here in California were and how they intimately affected the people that called Failoli home. You know, we have stories from some of our other staff that talk about, you know, what it was like to be here in this area, in parts of San Francisco, in the 20s, in the 30s, how difficult that could be for them at the time. And so Failoli has always been this diverse group of people, but that didn't make it always easy for everybody, especially outside of the acreage here. So just getting a chance to tell those new stories, whether they're good stories, ones that give us joy, or ones that remind us why we never need to recreate or relive those moments, learn from our past.
Julie Blythe-DeVere said she has memories of sitting down with the Mattson twins, who died a few years ago at ages 96 and 97. The curator says she believes the Failoli Gardens and historic home still holds many Hawaii stories to share in its future. The twins' mother, Lurleen Mattson Roth, died in 1985, one day after her 95th birthday. And it was back in 1975 that she donated the Failoli Estate to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And here's a fun fact for you. If you remember the television series Dynasty, well, the exterior of Failoli was used as the Carrington Mansion. That is it for today. Up tomorrow, more on the science and the tension on Mauna Kea. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call or talk back line. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or on Twitter at HI Conversation. This story and all the past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.